Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. I've been really intrigued by puzzles lately, and by puzzles I mean like paper-based puzzles or brain teasers, I guess. The little equations or problems written out on paper that present you with a thought exercise that you have to solve within some parameters. I used to see these in the backs of magazines, paper magazines, that I would look at the bookstore, like gamer magazines and things. And they would sometimes in the very back, you know, you'd see like a puzzle, like a brain teaser. And, you know, sometimes it would just be a word-based brain teaser, sort of like, I don't know, like the classic, you know, there are three doors or there are two doors and there's a guard in front of each one. And one says, I will tell you, I will always tell the truth. The other one says, I will always lie. So which one do you ask or whatever? Or, you know, there'd be like a chessboard and it would be mid-game and it would say that the next turn your opponent does such and such. And then on your next turn, you're able to checkmate the player. And you look at the thing and you're like, how is that going to happen? But you think through all the different possibilities and you finally get to the solution. So I've been really interested in these lately, and I spent a little bit of time creating some myself for fun, just to kind of exercise the part of the brain that solves those puzzles, except instead of solving them, invent some. I came up with some interesting ones. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you this, dear listener, is because the next thing in our list has nothing to do with paper puzzles, but it could be translated to paper really easily, I think. I could be wrong, but a variation of it could be. It's called K-Atomic, and that sounds like one of the KDE educational suite games or applications, but it's not. It's actually just a fun game that happens to be themed around atomic structures. I don't know what they're called when atoms get together. Molecules? I don't really know. Maybe they are molecules and they get together to make compounds. Is that a thing? It's compound? Compound molecule? There's compound adjectives, compound verbs. I figure there should be compound atoms and molecules. So it's themed around atoms and molecules, according to the handbook, the K-Atomic handbook. It could have just as easily been, and in fact, the game is interestingly themed. Aside from the object of the game is to replicate atomic structures that are given to you in the upper right corner, and then you have to move these pieces around a board. But the catch is that there's only I'll call it a receptor on one side or two sides or some number of sides on an atom. And you have to move these bits around, these little atoms around your board, until you can get them into the configuration described up at the top. But they don't stop. So when you set an atom in motion, it just keeps going until it hits a wall. Now, luckily, the game board is configured so that there are walls all over the place. But it's still kind of a feat of logic to maneuver the atoms into a corner of the board, or, you know, some corner of walls, so that you can get all of them in place. Because once again, they're not going to stop until they hit either another atom or another wall. So it's a little bit like one of those cheap sliding games, those tile games that you see that you used to get out of a pinata or something. You know, like those little tile games that you would have to, that it would be all scrambled and it would tell you that it was actually a picture of a happy face or something, and you'd have to slide the tiles around until you've got them in the correct order. That's kind of what this is, essentially, except with a more complex setup, a bigger range of things to slide around. As I was saying before I got off topic onto what the game is actually about, it could have just as easily been themed about around, like, I don't know, religious symbols or something, because the other theme of this game, like the board itself, is themed, at least by default, in a kind of ancient Egyptian theme. It has down at the right corner for just a decoration, it's got Amun. I guess it must be Amun. He's got a circle on his head and then the staff. So I guess that's got to be Amun or Amun. or Amun-Ra, I guess, depending on what iteration you prefer. Either way, it is funny to see the combination, the rather arbitrary combination of ancient Egyptian board with molecular structures being the goal. I'm assuming two things. One thing, in-game, I'm assuming that you're obviously reconstructing the form of of Amun-Ra, or of a pharaoh who was special to Amun-Ra, and you're reviving its mummy by reassembling molecules, obviously. Out of game, I'm assuming that this is a classic case of the power of open source, and probably the author of this game needed a quick and easy theme to build on, and grabbed components from K-Blocks and used it in K-Atomic. I could be wrong about that. I'm just entirely guessing. I mean, it could also be that the KDE game group got together and said, hey, we need a unified theme. Let's all settle on ancient Egypt as the setting for our games. And then people built on top of that, you know, games like K-Blocks and K-Atomic, maybe. But, I mean, other ones like Catman and K-Anagram and things like that, they don't use the ancient Egyptian themes. So, I don't know. Maybe it's a work in progress. Who knows? It's a mystery, and that's the fun of games. This is a fun game. It ramps up really fast, though, on my version, or at least at the difficulty level that I'm playing at, which I don't even actually... There's not even a choice. So whatever. Oh, but you can choose a level set. Oh, there. And all I have is original levels. Okay. So the just starting it up and starting to play, what I've experienced is it introduces you pretty quickly to a simple little three atom structure. And then once you, that's water. H, two H's and an O, H2O. It is educational. If you just think about it, and this is methane. Methane is very difficult to create. I know not in real life. In fact, I think we have problems with levels of methane in real life. But in game world, it is very difficult to create because it's four H's, hydrogen, and one C, which if only I had a periodic table. Oh, wait, I do. Calcium tells me that a C is carbon, so it's four hydrogen and one carbon, and that forms a, that's what makes methane, apparently. Didn't know that. So that's really cool. So this is strangely educational. That's really, really neat. I don't think this is an educational game. Like, I think that it's sneaking that in, I think. I don't think it's classified as a education. I think it's just classified as a KDE game, I think. Could be wrong. Anyway, that is K-Atomic, and what a fun little game. A real puzzler, like really cool. I could see that translating well to just an analog game. I mean, it'd be a little bit tough, and you'd have to, you know, you'd have to kind of, it would be difficult to solve entirely on paper. You might have to cut out pieces or something, but either way, it's within that range of you know, of an analog potential game, which does fascinate me. I think that as fun as much as I love video games, I also really do enjoy sort of the comfort of analog gaming. And I find it very, very intriguing how much we can do just with physical sort of game pieces, as it were, even if it's just on paper and just some X's and some O's and saying, okay, well, arrange it in this way without ever, you know, crossing this line or arrange it in this way, assuming that you can only move left, east, west, north, or south, no diagonal, you know, whatever. So, K-Atomic, check that out. It's really fun. All right, next up is K-Auth. That's K-A-U-T-H. K-Auth provides a convenient system-integrated way to offload actions that need to be performed as a privileged user, so root, generally, to small helper utilities. So let's look real quick at /var/log/packages/kauth. And you see pretty quickly that it's a bunch of include files. So these are just header files. There's no library here. It is exclusively a developer. I mean, I guess libraries often is aimed at the developer as well, but these are the raw materials for developers to build maybe libraries or to use in their application to build functions around for authentication. And this is good because sometimes you need administrative privileges to take some action. And it's always, I think, a little bit weird to think about permissions on a computer that you yourself own and no one else uses. In those cases, the concept of permissions just seems like a burden. It really does. It seems like more trouble than it's worth. And there are sort of two answers to that. One is that even though you might own your computer right now and no one else may ever use your computer right now and for the next 10 years or for the past 10 years, at some point, you never know, someone may be staying over at your place or they might just be a friend and you're out at a cafe and they need to use a computer. You know, there are instances where completely out of the blue and unexpectedly people actually use your computer. So there is that. Obviously in larger installs, lots of people do use a computer and yes, you do need the permissions. I really came up against that in a very, very major way at a movie studio that I used to work at. It was literally one of the largest supercomputers, or maybe the largest supercomputer in the Southern Hemisphere. Lots of people were using this thing, and it was a very interconnected system. It was all Linux and very often KDE. I think KDE was the default, and it was just, there was a lot happening all the time, and the stakes were high, because if someone accidentally deleted a scene that someone had been working on for the past 3 weeks or 6 months, that wouldn't be good. I mean, there were backups and stuff, but it's just, you know, the permissions really, really mattered. And there are other scenarios, I'm sure, where permissions are equally as important, government things and bank things and other things. So permissions are important, and yeah, you might not need them yourself all the time, but the system does need to be there. But that's not the only reason we need privileges, permissions. The other reason is that sometimes you have to protect yourself from yourself. Now, I realize that there's a whole strain of Linux users who don't want that. They don't ever want that for themselves. And I can respect that. I was probably that person at one point. I don't actually remember that I was. I feel like a little bit of protection from one's self, I did always appreciate. I don't feel like I ever, and we could go back and listen to old episodes, I guess, and find out, but I don't feel like I was ever adamantly opposed to a little bit of protection from silly mistakes. I mean, I don't, for instance, remember ever really being a fan of the RM tool, which is, you know, to this day, the command that I wish we would just get rid of. Like, literally, just get rid of it. I mean, you can keep it for backwards compatibility, but link it to something reasonable. So I don't remember ever thinking that I didn't want any kind of sort of safeguards, because safeguards are good for mistakes. And you can't, it is unreasonable to believe that you will never make a mistake at all, on a computer especially. It's just not rational to think that. And so permissions, they really do help you safeguard just against silly mistakes, whether it is literally a typo, you just accidentally type something that you didn't mean to type, or maybe you're in the wrong directory when you issue a dangerous command, or maybe you've scripted something and the script has gone off the rails a little bit for some reason, and so now it's out in the wrong directory doing things that you didn't intend for it to do, and so on. And you didn't set for it to exit on errors, so it just keeps going no matter what. So yeah, I think that permissions are important for that reason. But the other side, the flip side of that coin, of the coin of permissions and user privilege and stuff, is that it cannot be a bother. When it starts to become an actual burden to the user, then that's when users try to get around that system very reasonably. And this is why you would see, you'll see like new users sometimes choosing to run as root user, because why not? Like, why not just avoid the permission errors? Because it just seems like that's just too much trouble and they don't understand them. So root makes all that go away Yeah, let's just do that. That's completely understandable. It's why you see, I think, a lot of people run FAT FS as their thumb drive file system. External drives on Linux, if you don't understand how to use them, can be very confusing, because if you've got one user over here and one user over there, and suddenly you've got a permissions error when you feel that there shouldn't be any, because you're the same human using this thumb drive. You're supposed to be in charge here. Why is the computer telling you you don't have permission to do something to your own thumb drive? It can be very, very frustrating, especially if you don't know anything about ACL and how to set up users so that the UIDs are the same and so on. It can be frustrating. So KAuth is an important component to making permissions of actions on file systems more or less invisible, maybe not invisible, because they at some point a password is going to be required, but let's just say tolerable or manageable by a normal user. And otherwise, if we don't provide that, then users are just going to stop using permissions. And that in the end is going to hurt them, because they're going to do something silly to a file that they didn't mean to do something to, and it's going to bork their system. So KAuth is just an invaluable set of headers that I will likely never use myself. But developers who are developing for KDE are using it all the time, hopefully. It's the kind of thing that lets you add a printer to your system without, I don't know, exiting your GUI and logging back in as root, that sort of thing. So it's important. It's an important component. All right, let's talk about KBackup. KBackup is an application that lets you back up any folder or file into a tar archive to a local folder. So that could be something like an external hard drive, for instance, or a thumb drive, or a remote URL. So if you have permissions to send something up to a server somewhere, you can send your backups up there. And it's just included. Who knew? Like, really, who actually knew? KBackup just kind of snuck in. I don't know how long this has been around. I didn't even know it existed until this past week while going through the next set of applications for this show. It is a nice little application. It, you know, if you think of, if you ever used Deja Dupe, which is the, is that the GNOME backup utility? It's what we use at work. That's the default backup client at work. So I'm assuming it's the GNOME backup solution. It might be its own application that we just happen to use at work. I don't know. But if you've ever used that, the interface is very GNOME-ish. You launch GNOME or you launch Deja Dupe rather, and it's a single window with, I think, like literally one, probably two buttons, like set up a backup or backup. And so initially you set up a backup, you just tell it what folder you want to, or what device or what URL or whatever you want to backup to. You tell it, I think, the exclude folders, and that's it. And then you start backing up, and it schedules it and everything. It's very, very simple. It's quite nice, actually. It's really, I was very impressed with how sort of simple and elegant it is. KBackup, as you can imagine, if you're used to KDE, isn't quite as simple as that. When you open it up, it is an application that wants to take up a good half of your screen. It's horizontally laid out, which is nice. I'm not critiquing it for that. And on the left, there's a file tree. Is that what it's called? A file tree? Yeah, a file system tree of your home directory. And on the right, there is a target file chooser and some data about what you're about to back up, and a box for warnings and things like that. And then there's a big button with a big green plus sign on it. It says start backup. So it's not over complex. It is, I would say, for a KDE application, I would say this is pretty simple. And it's about as easy as Deja Dupe, to be honest. I mean, it's just, I will acknowledge that it's visually, when you first start it, it's not quite as basic as Deja Dupe. It's not going to sort of lure you in the way Deja Dupe does. But I think if this was the application that I had to back up with, and I guess it is, as it turns out, then I wouldn't be opposed to using this. Now, currently, as I've described on this show before, I don't back up my hard drive. I back up my thumb drive to my hard drive. So all of my data that I care about is on my thumb drive. And when I attach my thumb drive, it triggers a UDEV action to trigger a script that does an rsync between the thumb drive and my hard drive, with the thumb drive being the master copy. So that's my solution right now. But as I start to sort of think about making my home network a little bit more elaborate, I do start to think about, well, you know, I could do like a backup to a hard drive somewhere, a network attached storage somewhere. Now, I realize that's not offsite and there are issues there, but I could see this being something that I could use for a backup scheme. Of course, the KBackup is smart enough to be able to do incremental backups, so you're not literally just copying everything every single time and just building up a backup that keeps duplicating itself. You can do incremental backups and restore from incremental backups and so on. So it's a pretty intelligent backup tool. Now, of course, I'm saying this all in theory, to be clear. I'm not actively using KBackup. I've done a couple of tests. It's, again, pretty simple. You select the folder that you want to back up on the left from the file system, the file tree. And so I'll just select that. You select the folder that you want to back it up to. So I will, that's on the right panel. So I'll just make a new folder here called demo backup. So that folder exists now. And I set that as my target. And then I can do a start backup. And it will tell me what it's about to do. Oh, no, it's telling me what it's just done because it went so fast. Gives me a little bit of output telling me what just happened in the log panel, and no errors, so that's a good thing. And so that's done. That was a full backup. But of course, if you back up regularly, you know that full backups are one thing. The everyday incremental backups are the other thing. And KBackup does do incremental backups, so it is capable of doing that. You just have to kind of set it up a little bit. So the way that you do that is you have to create a profile. So you go to File, Profile Settings, and in Profile Settings, you can name your profile thing, so My Backup, and you can tell it how big you want your archive to be limited to. I just leave it as unlimited, of course. Number of full backups to keep. You can tell it how many full backups you want to keep. Again, I set it to unlimited, but eventually, you know, one might increment that to just storing the past 12 or the past 20 or whatever. But what is a full backup? Well, right now it's just whenever you click the big button that says full backup, but or start backup, whatever it says, start backup. But if you set the full backup interval, currently by default it is set to every day. If you set that to some other value other than every day, then the next backup you do after you do a full backup is automatically set to do just an incremental backup, which may include nothing if you haven't changed anything on your hard drive, but or in the directory that you have set to be your backup source. But until it ticks over to the next scheduled full backup, anytime you launch KBackup, it only does an incremental backup. And an incremental backup looks exactly like a full backup, except without all the full stuff. So you put, you know, if you're restoring, it'll put the full and the incremental together to give you the sort of the sum total of the resulting full system. And that's in profile settings. So that's, you create a profile, then of course you would want to save it, unless you want to do that every single time you ever open up KBackup. But you can save that profile as your profile. You do have to load the profile when you go back into KBackup, or else it won't know, you know, what the interval is that it's looking for in order to do the next full backup and so on. But yeah, that's KBackup. And you can run KBackup from a terminal too. So you don't actually have to launch the GUI. So that means that you can cron KBackup. So if you just type in KBackup --help, as you can imagine, you can tell it with a profile argument. So KBackup and then whatever, my backup. Then it'll launch a KBackup job using that profile that you saved. So you can schedule that in cron or Anacron, better yet, and then you're good to go. Every time your computer is awake, it will check in with KBackup and perform either a full backup or an incremental backup, depending on what KBackup has recorded as the last known backup time. And like I say, I think I would do that with Anacron. I don't know if we talked about Anacron. We must have talked about Anacron. I would do that with Anacron because that way, no matter whether your computer has been off for 5 days and then you come back and let's say you turn it off before 11 p.m., which is when you have your backup script set to run, but you didn't do that. So you turn it off before 11, so it never kicks off, and then your computer's off for another 2 days and you finally come back and, you know, so on. So it starts to add up and you it's like this game of cat and mouse with your cron job that starts KBackup. Whereas Anacron, it checks in with tasks that you have scheduled every time you turn on the computer. And if it detects that it has not run, for instance, KBackup since it was scheduled last, then it will run it then. So Anacron doesn't necessarily care about real days. It cares about powered on days. So that is KBackup. Really useful, really nice little application. And I just can't believe I didn't know it existed. But who knows, maybe it is brand new. I mean, for all I know, it's a new thing with KDE 5. I don't know. I didn't look into its history. I do know that I've never noticed it before, and I'm really, really happy that it's there. So if you're looking for a backup, an easy backup client for your KDE, KBackup could be the way to go. Let's take a coffee break. I know that I am in the mood for a cup of coffee. You probably are too. So let's go do that. We'll come back. We'll talk about KBlackBox, followed by KBlocks. Okay, we're back, and I've got my coffee. You've got your coffee. We need to talk about KBlackBox, but first I want to back up a little bit and talk about KBackup again. I just want to note, because I realized I didn't make it clear, it's just tar archives. That's what it does. It uses standard Unix tooling to create your backups. So if KBackup is something that you start using and then you fall out of the habit, or you decide to change desktops and you decide that KBackup isn't the thing that you want, but then the unthinkable happens and your hard drive dies, but you've got all these backups on this remote, on your backup drive. For some reason, you suddenly have just your data and no access to KBackup. Doesn't matter. As long as you have tar, you're good to go. That is a great comfort, I think, to, well, anyone who cares about backups. The backups are only as good as the interface through which you access those backups. And that's important. I mean, I know that early on in my computing career, or my computing life, I should say, I used to, you know, I would try to be good and back things up. And there were dime a dozen shareware, dime a dozen free bundled with this hard drive or what is this external hard drive, you know, backup applications. And me not knowing what I was doing at the time, I would just use whatever was thrown in front of me. It's a backup application. Let's try that. And half of them would, you know, they weren't supported. They weren't maintained at all. They were just thrown onto something as an apparent added value. And you don't think about that if you don't know what you're doing. So you use these backup applications only to find in 6 months that the backup application itself has disappeared. Now, luckily, that never affected me because I never found myself needing to access a backup without the application. I got lucky and I would just phase out, you know, so all those backups were just deleted and then the next application would get dropped in and start, it would make new backup archives that I would not be able to access in 6 months or a year or 2 years, whatever. So I went through that cycle several times, I feel, before I discovered open source. And then I realized that within open source, there was actual longevity in mind and things tended to just use tar archives. I mean, to be fair, half of those dime a dozen backup applications that I used to use back before I knew what open source was, who knows, they could have been using tar as well, and I just wouldn't have known what a tar archive was or how to untar it and where to put the data. But either way, KBackup uses tar. You could use you can use your standard tools to get to your data in a pinch. Now let's talk about KBlackBox. KBlackBox is one of the most clever games I have played in a long time, to be honest with you. It is a, again, kind of a puzzle-solving game in which you get to use laser beams to discern the location of crystal balls inside of a black box. So this is really, really clever, and it is just so much fun. It's a little bit complex, but if you step through the tutorial, you'll definitely get it. And if you click around enough, you might figure it out. I did not figure it out. I had to do the tutorial. But I do feel now that, of course, with the benefit of understanding from the tutorial, I think if I'd clicked around a little bit more, I think I could have eventually figured it out. So the game board is a black box, but there are receptors on, that's the second time in this episode I've used the term receptors, receptors on all four edges of the black box. And these receptors, or I guess they're not receptors actually, well, they're something. They are both the recipients of and the emitters of a laser beam. Now, you don't really get to see the laser, probably in real life, you don't get to see lasers either, as I understand, but you can click on these. They take the form of little green triangles, and you can click on them to send a laser through the black box. And then you look on some other receptor to see where the laser hit. And based on what the lasers are doing inside that black box, you can ideally figure out where these crystal balls are located. It's really, really fascinating. So, for instance, let's say, well, it looks like there's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. 10 receptors or emitters, whatever, triangles across all each edge of the black box. The more you click, the lower your score. And the longer it takes you, I think, the lower the score. I haven't really tracked time all that well. But I'm going to click the top left receptor. And okay, so it gives me the icon of a little arrow going into a dot. So I know that somewhere along the path of this laser beam, it has stopped. So it hasn't reached another receptor. It went into the black box and encountered a ball and ended there. So logically, if I go to the receptor on the far, on the opposite end and click that, I should see an arrow going into a dot, because I'm assuming that if this very first one collided with a crystal ball, then surely the one just opposite is going to collide with a ball as well. Now, I don't know that there's only one ball in this top row, so they could be colliding into separate things, but I'll do that. Yeah, so that's it has collided with something. So that tells me information. It tells me that there's definitely a ball in the top row of my black box. Now, I don't know which column it is in. That's a complete mystery. So there are 10 columns. All I know is that somewhere along in this row, there's either one or more crystal balls. And I see that there are 2, 4, 6 crystal balls in the black box, because there are 6 little ball icons in the top left of the game board. So I know that I have to find 6. One of them is in this top row. So now I could start clicking on the top, you know, the columns, and try to find where that ball is in this row. That's an expensive, you know, just kind of brute force it. That's expensive, and to some degree, it doesn't necessarily always, it's not always useful right away, because if I were to click, for instance, on the first column, and if it came up with an arrow and a dot, which it conveniently did, actually, then that's telling me potentially that the crystal ball is in the top, very top left corner of the black box. But then again, that crystal ball could be anywhere in that column. So we're triangulating, except without the triangles, these locations of obstacles in the black box, and you continue to do that. Now, so far, bizarrely, and this is that's not happened so far, but bizarrely, every single button I've clicked has rendered an arrow into a dot. That's not usually what happens. So I'm going to continue, and I'll presumably find out that at some point I've got a laser that does something that behaves differently. So what I'll do here is I will click the second one down, the second row, and this one turns into a number one, which tells me that it hit a different receptor on some other end of the black box. But in order to find what receptor that is, I have to click around and try to find another one. So in other words, something in the black box, and that's not, we don't know what it is inside the black box. There are little mirrors or something, refract the lasers. So in this case, one has gone to another thing labeled one, but I don't see that label yet. So if I click on the second row, it turns into a two. So now there's another receptor somewhere out there that just got hit by that laser. The next row is an arrow and a dot again. There's yet another icon that I'm looking to get here. So I'll click on the next row. There it is. So this one has a little U-turn symbol, meaning that the laser has come back to this same receptor. And once again, it's not really explained, I don't think, in the tutorial, like in the game, what's causing that reaction. And the tricky thing is that it could be, I believe it could be a crystal ball, or I think, could be wrong, I think it can also just be a, it can be a, you know, an invisible, like a, I don't know, a game world, like a mirror, or a, you know, the strangeness of in-game lasers, like that some of them just turn around and come back to where you shot them from. So not entirely realistic, probably, and I don't know what the setup is supposed to be. You'd think that after a solution, maybe it would insert like little mirrors or something to show you why things are refracting, but it doesn't do that. But either way, through a bunch of deduction and a couple of clues and some guesswork, you end up being able to map out exactly where each and every crystal ball is in the black box. And when you're done, you click the done button and you see how well you did. If it's getting really, really frustrating, you can go up to the top and click the solve button, and it just shows you where the balls were, which is nice. And that's a valid way to kind of get the hang of it. After I did the tutorial, I did that a couple of times. I clicked on all the green arrows, and then I clicked on solve to see, sort of like to get the hang of the mapping. Because the U-turns especially really, really confused me. At first, I thought that the U-turns meant that it was hitting a ball and being refracted back. But it actually just means, like I say, for whatever reason, like in the game, the laser just decides to come back to you for no good reason. I don't know. Maybe there's a nuance I'm missing there, but that's kind of what I got from it. Really, really clever game, though. Really threw me for a loop. I didn't expect for it to be maybe that fun. And boy, is it addicting, because it's just, I mean, it is a black box, and you think, how am I going to figure this out? But eventually you do, you figure it out. Okay, I feel like I've done K-blocks. I don't know why, I feel like I've talked about that. Maybe I have, maybe I haven't. But K-blocks is a Tetris-like game, falling block game. Yeah, apparently I have not talked about K-blocks. Bizarre, I swear I've talked about that before. Maybe I've just talked about Tetris so much that I think I've talked about K-blocks. So K-blocks is by default themed as an Egyptian sort of setup. You can do a single game, and it is exactly what you would think if you've ever played Tetris. It is the exact same setup. It is a big column. You've got falling bricks. Oh, I just screwed that up. You've got falling bricks, and you can position them ideally so that you fill up a row with solid amount of bricks. And if you're quite confident in your positioning, you can just send a brick to the bottom of the row with the space bar, and that just drops it almost immediately, like instantaneously. And when you get a row full, of course it disappears. So the idea is that these bricks are falling and falling and falling, but as you stack them neatly together, they disappear, making room for more bricks. But of course, the catch is that almost all the bricks are more than one row high. I mean, you can rotate them, but they're all more than one row high, so quite possibly you'll be stacking these things and eliminating row by row, but adding, you know, three rows or two rows or several rows on top of each other as you go. And so it starts to add up quicker than sort of possible for you to make it disappear. And that's the game. That's the famous game of Tetris, except it's not Tetris, it's K-Blocks. There are different themes for... I'm pressing space to pause, and that's not working out. There are different themes, so if you're not into the Egyptian theme, you can change it. You go to configure K-Blocks, and there's an Egyptian theme, and then there's the oxygen theme. I prefer the Egyptian theme myself. There's also a button to get new themes, and there are a couple out there. There's a funny one called Space Invaders or something like that, and Space Invaders. And it themes the whole thing to look sort of like that old pixel, you know, the pixelated game of Space Invaders. It doesn't change the game itself. It just now looks like Space Invaders a little bit instead of K-Blocks. There's also a Europe theme, which ships with its own sound set. So those are the two that I know of. At least that's what comes up when you click to get new themes. I did install the Space Invaders one, and I messed around with it for a little bit, but it does get a little bit confusing because you're looking at these bricks, but they look like Space Invader characters, and it's a little bit off. It'll throw you off a little bit, but the Egyptian one I really like, so that's what I've been doing. And there are different modes. You can play on easy, you can do medium and hard, and change the difficulty level, and that just controls really the speed, the starting speed of the bricks. I feel like no matter what difficulty you play, I would feel like it starts to get faster. I don't remember. I didn't play on easy for very long. I played on easy long enough to understand that there were other level settings, because easy is really easy. It goes really, really slow. And if you've played Tetris for any amount of time in your life, that will be too easy. So I just started hard and go for as long as I possibly can, which sometimes is better than others. So anyway, that's Tetris, that's K-Blocks. I've probably told the story before, but Tetris really was the gateway to open source for me in a bizarre way. I heard about a cool trick in a terminal that you could do to play Tetris in a terminal, and I thought that sounded like a really great trick to know for those long days at work where you don't have anything to do, but you want to do something, but you don't have, like, literally you don't have anything to do. So I thought, well, it would be fun to have Tetris just on hand, like no matter what, you just have Tetris. So I looked into that, and it was, of course, it was the trick, they call it a trick, was to launch Emacs and then to type in escape X and then the word Tetris and then return, and then you've got Tetris, and it works. It actually works if you do that. I mean, of course it works. For me, that was a huge discovery, though. And so I was playing Tetris for a very long time in Emacs, but well before I knew open source existed. Like, I did not know open source was a thing, but I was playing Tetris in Emacs. And it was through that, because I started exploring Emacs, that I discovered this thing called the GNU public license. And from the GNU public license, of course, I mean, that explained in great detail, or maybe it was a document about the license, something like that. But it explains in great detail, obviously, what open source is all about. And from there, I discovered Linux and then started this podcast. So that was kind of the progression. And it literally did. It started with me wanting to play Tetris during the slow hours at a computer store that I was working at. That was it. Okay, that's enough Tetris right now. And we need to go on to the next application, which is K-Bookmarks. I thought it was K-Bounce. Sounded a lot more fun than K-Bookmarks. But K-Bookmarks is the next one. It's easy. /var/log/packages/K-Bookmarks. As you can possibly imagine, this is a bunch of include files. And these are resources for applications written within the KDE framework to use a common format for bookmarks in web browsers, but it could be used where local files or URLs can be saved as bookmarks as well. I don't know for a fact that this works. For instance, does Dolphin use kbookmarks to denote locations in the places panel? I don't actually know. I haven't looked at the Dolphin code recently. I've looked at the Dolphin code. I've not looked at it recently to see whether it uses kbookmarks, include, you know, kbookmark header files. But I do kind of wonder if that's possibly where it would get used. But I mean, it would certainly get used in something like Conqueror, obviously, and maybe even Falcon. I wouldn't be surprised. Next up is K-Balance, and it is the most frustrating game I've played in a long time. I said K-Black Box was one of the most clever. This is one of the most frustrating, and I mean frustrating in a good way. It is sort of, if you will, an inverse K-Blocks. The goal of the game is to fill up your game board with rows of blocks, but instead of sort of, you know, in K-Blocks, you're doing that, but they disappear when you fill them up. In this case, your board essentially is disappearing as you are filling it in. That's the goal. The problem is that there are these two bouncing balls roaming around your board. I mean, like, you know, not roaming, but bouncing around your board. And they're fine as long as they do not collide with the little spacecraft that you're sending out to fill in the board. So essentially the mechanic is that you use your mouse to target some portion of the board and you click on it to fill in a row. Now, if a bouncy ball hits the row that you are filling in before it is completely filled in. So it sort of, it selects you when you click, it sort of selects the row and it starts filling in these blocks one by one. If a ball crosses that threshold before it has turned into bricks, then game over. That's it. You are finished. Really kind of brutal, to be honest. And the danger is, of course, that you get really kind of confident and you think, okay, well, I'll just really quickly fill in, you know, this part of the board because surely it won't get back to me then. But of course they're very predictable actually. But strangely, it feels rather unpredictable. Now, you do have a secret weapon, which is the right click. And you can right click to cause your walls to be built vertically rather than horizontally. The goal, the end goal, is to fill in something like 75% of the board with blocks. As you progress, you get more bouncy balls. So it gets a lot more difficult. You know, I mean, my strategy so far has been to sort of segment each bouncing ball as I can into its own space so that I have a little bit less chaos. But that doesn't always work, and they are really fast. And once you start getting more than one, of course, you get into trouble. So, it can be difficult. It's really strangely frustrating because you have no control over the speed of your wall building process. And especially in the beginning of the game, of course, you've got all day. You can wait till the balls bounce off of the ground and you see them go up. So then you're building your wall down on the ground. I mean, that's really easy. And then of course you learn to start, just start a little bit higher. Like, why start on row one if you can kind of escalate and just kind of wait for those balls to more or less get past the fifth row, and then you could start filling that in, and then you start doing vertical segments and so on. But as the as you, of course, increase in level, you start getting more balls, so there's more of a threat of it getting in the way of your walls, and so it gets really pretty tough pretty quickly. Really fun. Like, I've never seen this is a new game to me. Like, this mechanic is entirely new to me. I don't know if this is emulating an old game that I just don't know about. It's kind of, to me, it's like I say, an inverse of K-Blocks and sort of like the evil twin of Pong, ping pong, because those balls will kill you. Like, they will absolutely, they will smash, they will stop your wall from being built, and you will the end of the game will occur. So it is, it's a fun little use of really basic physics in-game physics and just the frustration of why don't you move faster, you silly wall building mechanism. But you'll get to places where it actually starts to work out for you. And like I say, as long as you get, like, you know, I think it's 75% of the board, I think, is the goal, then you get to progress. But I mean, it just keeps adding more ping pong balls, so it does get difficult. There is an increased difficulty, and I have not dared go any higher than easy. Again, the default theme is what they call Egyptian. It's got sort of a little silhouette of a pyramid in the background, so I quite like that. But there are other themes. There's strange geometry, which is kind of a blue and white theme. Oxygen, which is actually not very oxygeny to me, but it does exist. There's roads and the beach. So I've played the strange geometry and the Egyptian theme, and I think really the Egyptian theme is my favorite. But the strange geometry is quite nice because the wall building mechanism looks like a little red laser, and it looks kind of fun. But I don't know, the board looks a little bit busy to me for the in the strange geometry. So I just keep it on the Egyptian theme. I'm kind of a sucker for the whole ancient Egyptian kind of mummy theme. So that's what I tend to like that in these KDE games. I actually quite appreciate that. So that is K-Bounce. Not what you might think. You know, you might think K-Bounce, so it's just going to be a Pong clone or something. But no, it's actually really, really fun. It is the opposite. Like I say, the evil twin of Pong. All right, next up, I think probably the last one for this episode, K-Breakout. So if you like breaking through walls, this is the game. If you've ever played a game called Brickout, I think is what it used to be called, then you have essentially played K-Breakout. There's a little ping pong paddle at the bottom of the board, of the screen, and there's a little ping pong ball or a wrecking ball or something that bounces off of your paddle up against bricks, and the bricks are destroyed by the ping pong ball or the wrecking ball, whatever kind of ball this is. It's a pretty classic game, and of course, as you increase levels, it gets harder, and the physics are always a little bit, just, you know, you have to get the feel for the physics. Not that the physics are not realistic, it's just that it does get different. It gets you know, you get used to how things work, and then they bounce a little bit differently depending on the angle and so on. So as you progress in levels, it becomes, and I don't actually know all that much about Breakout. I don't exactly remember that game particularly. I do remember a game called Arkanoid. I don't know if any of you have played that one. That's an old game that was sort of Breakout with bonus. You know, it was like Breakout and then some. So what would happen in Arkanoid, at least, and maybe this is true of Breakout, like I say, I don't know Breakout very well. What would happen in Arkanoid is that you would get power-ups. Like, some of the bricks that you were breaking through would have an effect on something. So for instance, one of them might cause your paddle to become sticky. And so whenever you hit the ball, or whenever the ball comes back to your paddle, it doesn't bounce off. You have to fire it again, which is the space bar by default. You can set it to be the mouse as well, but by default, it's the space bar. And so that can be good for you, or it can be annoying. It just kind of depends. Some of the bricks have bonus points. Some of the bricks have shrink your paddle. That can be troublesome. That can be quite a problem. And these aren't reversible. They're power-ups that you have gained, and for the rest of that level, that's what you have as your setting. So some are good, some are bad. Now, you do have to catch them, which can be tough, because then you're trying to manage both the trajectory of the ball as well as trying to catch those bonus bricks, and that'll screw you up sometimes, because you'll go for the brick even though the ball is right there and you should really go get that. Oh, it just fell off the board, you're dead. So yeah, it's a fun little game. It can be, you know, towards the end of each level, it can be a little bit tedious, because there's just like three bricks and you can't get to them because you're, you know, you have to wait for the physics to work out for you and so on. So I don't know, it does have a pacing problem probably, but I mean, that's classic Breakout, really. I mean, that's just how that goes. But it's fun. I mean, this is a fun game, and like I say, if you have any memory of like Breakout or Arkanoid or any of those kinds of games, I mean, I think there were like, you know, a handful of clones, certainly probably through the years. I mean, even heck, even a little bit of like, what is it, Tux Bubble or Ice Bubble or Ice Tux, the one where you're hitting the little crystal frozen balls with Tux or something, and then they fall and they cascade. It's not exactly like that, but it's same idea, essentially. Destruction of some structure and the threat being that you might lose track of where things are and not be able to destroy everything in time. So that's K Breakout. It's a lot of fun. Try it out. I mean, if you've never played one of those games, definitely try it out, because you have to play one of those games in your life. I think that's everything, though. Next time we're going to start with K-Bruch, K-B-R-U-C-H. It's a small program to practice calculating with fractions. So that's what we're going to start with. But I have to go to OpenStax, that's O-P-E-N-S-T-A-X, to refresh my memory on how to calculate with fractions. Or maybe K-Bruch will help me, but I should probably brush up on it first. That's what we'll do next time. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in a week.